Tens of billions of dollars have been made selling the death and destruction of gangster rap music. And while we think of the West Coast, mostly when we think of gangster rap, it was also born in New York City, especially Southeast Queens, the home of more hip-hop icons than any place in America. From Run-DMC and LL Cool J, Russell Simmons, Def Jam Records, Ja Rule, 50 Cent, the founders of FUBU Clothing, iconic video director Hype Williams, they all hail from the same little corner of Queens. And at the center of Queens hip-hop history is a man called Supreme. Kenneth McGriff got his street name Supreme from his involvement with the 5%er movement. The 5%ers broke off from the Nation of Islam in the 1950s. They came to dominate the New York State prison system among black inmates. So when young Ken McGriff started working the streets of Jamaica, Queens, it was only natural that he would end up running with the Nation of Gods and Earths, as they call themselves. The 5%ers have a penchant for grandiose names, as they consider their members to all be gods. And young Kenneth McGriff was christened as Supreme. So in the early 80s, McGriff rounded up some other young 5%ers in Jamaica, Queens, to take advantage of the exploding cocaine business, carving out a lucrative street-level business composed of numerous teenage workers who sold crack by the nickel and dime.
Crack has become America's drug of choice.
A potent, inexpensive, highly addictive form of cocaine.
It is an uncontrolled fire.
They became known as the Supreme Team. And their leader, Kenneth McGriff, could soon be seen riding the streets of Queens in a special bulletproof Mercedes-Benz. To really understand Supreme and the Supreme Team, you have to understand Jamaica, Queens. In the 2000 census, Queens was the only major county in the entire United States where black household income was higher than white household income. But the neighborhood of South Jamaica, where Supreme was from, was the bad part of Southeast Queens, where the projects were at, where the poor people lived.
Cops on the run, criminals running from them. It's just another Sunday in South Jamaica. The police ran a check on this car. It came up a 16, a stolen vehicle. The man tried to take the car in front of six cops. The cops won. But in this part of Queens, the cops don't always win.
This area, mostly drugs probably, from what I see. But you have a little bit of everything, robbery, burglary, and just as you saw, stolen cars.
How bad is this place?
I'd say it's bad.
So when the crack cocaine epidemic hit in 84, spots like Guy Brewer Boulevard and the Baisley Projects became gold mines for the Supreme Team and other dealers. Black and white middle class buyers from the surrounding areas swarmed South Jamaica looking to buy drugs. The biggest dealer in South Jamaica in the early 80s was Lorenzo Fat Cat Nichols. Now Fat Cat was a solid working class kid with a nurse's aide for a mother and a professional plumber for a father. Nichols had the connection for lots and lots of cocaine, supposedly from his contacts with the Italian mafia, and he was supplying the Supreme Team in the early 80s. At the same time, hip-hop was slowly bubbling up into the pop culture. And right next door to Kenneth Supreme McGriff in South Jamaica was Hollis, Queens, home of the first big crossover rap group, Run-DMC. And probably the single most important person in hip-hop history, Russell Simmons, who was the brother of Run from Run-DMC. He was launching his Def Jam Records from the home base of Hollis, and right around the corner from them was the soon-to-be megastar LL Cool J. From the beginning, the Supreme Team and other Queens drug dealers were hobnobbing with these soon-to-be megastars, paying for concert performances and supplying some of them with drugs, whether for personal use or for sale. Run-DMC's DJ, Jay Master Jay, even married the sister of James Wall Corley, who was part of the same drug-dealing circle as Supreme and Fat Cat Nichols. In 85, Fat Cat Nichols was indicted and locked up for drug conspiracy. And you can see hip-hop founding fathers Curtis Blow and Busy B up on stage with Supreme and his crew for Fat Cat's going away party.
I'm gonna make a special dedication to my man, my brother, waiting with us right now, he wears some heart and mind. Fat Cat!
In 1987, the Supreme Team was at its peak, grossing up to supposedly $200,000 in a single day. then they were hit with an indictment. Supreme McGriff somehow managed to escape with a relatively light 10-year sentence. In his absence, nephew Gerald Prince Miller took over the Supreme Team and things took a violent turn. The feds claim the Supreme Team was responsible for 8 murders in 1987 alone, though Supreme was never charged with any of those. Gerald Prince Miller, his nephew, was himself sent away for a short stretch in late 87. With both Supreme and Prince off the streets, the Supreme Team was out of business for the time being. While the Supreme Team was in a sort of hiatus, an event occurred in their old Southside turf that would mark the end of the golden age of crack dealing in Queens and America.
A Queens grand jury is going to convene tomorrow to consider the case against 4 young men accused of executing rookie cop Edward Byrne. He was gunned down while guarding a witness in a drug case. It happened in Jamaica, Queens, the same neighborhood where 3 of the 4 suspects grew up.
Rookie police officer Ed Byrne, who was guarding the home of a witness in an upcoming drug trial that included Fat Cat Nichols, chief lieutenant, still on the streets, a man named Pappy Mason, was assassinated by members of Mason's Bebo's gang.
I said at my son's wake, our streets could end up being as lawless as the streets of Bogota and Beirut. Individually, we cannot take on the drug dealers. They are an army. They are a massive army.
Welcome to the 40s Project. 2 of the men accused of shooting police officer Ed Byrne grew up here. Some people call it the largest crack house in the city. It's 5 blocks of projects, drugs, and crime. It's a place that even frightens cops.
I get scared, but I have to do my job as a police officer.
There's a big battle raging in these streets of Jamaica, Queens. On one side, the largest police force in the country. On the other side, drug dealers, armed to the teeth and with untold wealth. Many people in the neighborhood are afraid.
We need an army, a big army.
In the aftermath of Byrne's murder, the New York Police Department swarmed the streets of the rotten apple, especially in South Jamaica. And when Prince Miller got out in 89 and tried to put the old team back together, his days were numbered. Prince and others were eventually charged with luring 4 Colombian cocaine suppliers to the Baisley public housing projects, where they killed them and took their cocaine. But their bodies were never found. While the Supreme Team and the entire Jamaica drug scene was being decimated by law enforcement, Kenneth Supreme McGriff was safely tucked away in federal prison, serving a relatively light 12-year sentence for drug conspiracy, which immunized him from any of the trouble that his nephew and old crew got themselves into. Finally, out on parole in 93, Supreme found the streets of New York and South Jamaica very different from the days he went away in 87. The golden age of selling drugs was coming to an end. Most of the big players from the 80s were either dead or locked up. But a new hustle had sprung up in Southeast Queens, one that was making young guys even more money than drugs did in the 80s. It was called hip-hop. Supreme's old associate Russell Simmons's fledgling record label Def Jam, along with his clothing line Fat Farm, was now worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Local rappers Run-DMC had become global icons. LL Cool J was a budding movie star. FUBU Clothing, started by 2 guys from Hollis, Queens, was approaching $1 billion in sales. The pop culture styles of Southeast Queens, a culture that Supreme had helped in some small way to create, had spread across America and the world and was generating tens of billions in profit. Supreme wanted in. He quickly latched on to Murder Inc. Records CEO Irv Gotti, another South Jamaica native who was an up-and-comer in the rap business. Supreme and Irving Gotti Lorenzo needed each other. Irv Gotti got street cred from connecting with Supreme, and Supreme got entree into the entertainment business. Murder Inc.'s top artist Ja Rule scored a string of hits starting in 99, and Supreme was along for the ride. But in 2000, Supreme found himself mediating a beef between yet another local Jamaica rapper, future megastar 50 Cent, who had been discovered by Run-DMC's DJ, Jam Master Jay. 50 Cent, probably just to make a name for himself, instigated the beef when he took credit for Ja Rule's chain getting snatched, which Supreme claims was a lie. But either way, now not long after that song, Curtis 50 Cent Jackson was shot 9 times in front of his grandmother's house in South Jamaica. Word on the street was Supreme did it. But a man named Daryl Hamo Baum probably was the culprit. And Little Kim's one-time boyfriend, Damian World Hardy, who was a Brooklyn kingpin, was eventually convicted of having Baum killed in retaliation for yet another hit. Baum had once been Mike Tyson's bodyguard and personal friend, and Tyson supposedly put his own $50,000 hit out on World Hardy and his brother Wise for killing Baum. New York rap and hip-hop and murder was intertwined right from the start. So after recovering from his gunshots, 50 Cent used his notoriety to explode onto the scene, becoming the top-selling rapper of the early 2000s. Meanwhile, another piece of Queens drug violence would finally seal Supreme's fate. McGriff's old buddy from the Supreme Team days, a guy named Black Just, had been shot and killed by sometimes rapper and well-known Queens drug dealer, a guy named E Moneybags, right in front of Supreme's own eyes. He was very upset, to say the least, about witnessing one of his oldest friends being murdered right in front of him. In 2001, Supreme took revenge by hiring a hitman to kill E Moneybags and, unbelievably, having his underlings videotape the hit. In 2002, Queens legend Jam Master Jay was murdered in his studio by unknown assailants. Supreme was even a suspect in that case. He supposedly wanted revenge for Jam Master Jay signing 50 Cent. But to this day, no one has ever been charged in Jam Master Jay's murder. Meanwhile, Supreme's ventures in the entertainment business weren't bearing much fruit. All Supreme had managed to produce for himself entertainment-wise was a low-budget, straight-to-DVD movie called Crime Partners, which failed to make Griff a real player in the entertainment world. So, according to the DEA, Supreme had returned to the drug business, mainly running heroin to the Baltimore, Maryland area. After raiding several stash spots, the feds took Supreme into custody, and their prized piece of evidence was the videotape of E. Moneybags' murder, which had been left laying around one of the stash spots. Irv Gotti and Murder, Inc. were soon swept up by the federal probe, and Irving Lorenzo, aka Irv Gotti, along with his brother, were charged with money laundering for Supreme. Too bad for them, Supreme had been using Murder, Inc. registered phones to transact some of his business. Irv Gotti and Murder, Inc. were actually eventually found not guilty in a jury trial, but it was too late for Kenneth Supreme McGriff. In early 07, McGriff was found guilty of paying hitmen, who testified against him, to commit 2 murders, including that of E. Moneybags, along with drug and money laundering crimes, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, just like his nephew Gerald Prince Miller. And that's the story of Supreme, currently serving life no parole in federal prison. But I thought it would be interesting to hear from somebody with a unique perspective, somebody who was friends with Supreme in federal prison.
I went to prison in 1993 for an LSD conspiracy. I wasn't no Pablo Escobar type of dude, but for a teenager, I was doing decent sized stuff. I was supplying 15 colleges in 5 states with LSD and marijuana. I was locked up in the feds for 21 years. I was in about 8 different federal prisons. I met a lot of people, a lot of convicts, a lot of gangsters, a lot of bank robbers. I started writing books in the mid-2000s. And through my books that I wrote mostly like on prison stuff and gangsters, I started meeting a lot more dudes. A lot of people were interested in my work. And eventually, I met Kenneth Supreme McGriff at FCI Gilmer in 2004. When I met Supreme in 2004, I knew who he was. I didn't know all the implications of everything he had done and all his legendary status, but I heard about him. He was a big dude on the compound, and he knew who I was too. At that time, I'd been writing stuff for Don Diva and Feds Magazine, and I had my first book out, Prison Stories, and he was really interested in the type of stuff that I was doing. So we started talking a lot, and I really got to know him, and I got to know his story, and he told me a lot of stuff about when he was out there with Irv Gotti and Murder, Inc. and a lot of stuff about 50 Cent. But even when I used to ask Supreme about 50 Cent, you know, I mean, he didn't really have no problem with the kid. He thought the kid was a go-getter, you know, he was doing his stuff, but he didn't like it. You know, Supreme had 1 foot in the entertainment business, he had 1 foot in the streets. and 50 Cent was out there putting his name in the mix. You know, I was around Supreme personally, and what I found was he was like a real gentleman type of gangster. I mean, don't get it wrong, dude was gangster. He would handle his business as necessary, but he was really, you know, kind of laid back, you know, real diplomatic. You know, he wouldn't use his force or, you know, anything like that unless you forced his hand. You know, but don't get it fucked up. If you made the wrong move, Supreme's gonna handle business. He's gonna do what he has to do because he has all type of people that are gonna do his bidding and do whatever he says. He's just a real magnetic, a real charismatic, a real intelligent type of dude. And really, when he speaks, it's like people listen because he doesn't really speak that much. So when he does say something, everybody's kind of like on the edge of their seat, like, okay, what did Supreme say? Supreme said this. And dudes are ready to enforce his orders like that. I used to walk the compound with Supreme a lot, and we would walk around, you know, and we'd be going here or there. You know, you only got 10 minutes to move, so you got to get to where you're going. And a lot of guys were always coming up to Supreme, and they wanted to talk to him. They wanted to, like, spit 16 verses at him or tell him about this idea or this book or this song that they had. And Supreme was always real gracious. He would always talk to these dudes and give them time. I used to tell Supreme sometimes after these dudes left, I was like, Why you always let these crackheads just come up and monopolize your time? Or why do you even talk to them? These dudes are crackheads. And he told me seriously, he was like, man, sometimes you can learn a lot from a crackhead.
So there you have it. The story of hip-hop's transformation from a New York neighborhood phenomenon into a billion-dollar business. The trail of bodies upon bodies that went along with it, and a man they still call Supreme. Today, the old Jamaica Queens crew is more successful and powerful than ever. Russell Simmons does yoga and dispenses life skills advice. 50 Cent sells vodka. Run of Run DMC is a so-called reverend with not one but three TV shows on cable, including a show where the good reverend remodels a different room in his palatial home every episode. LL Cool J plays a cop on television. Damon John of FUBU is an investment guru. But Jam Master Jay is dead, his killer's walking free, and Kenneth Supreme McGriff, a key influence for the hip-hop culture of egotism and materialism that has infected global culture, will never be a free man again. Supreme isn't a big guy, he wasn't known for violence, but from his days as a teenage leader in the Five Percenters, to building the Supreme team into a drug-dealing machine, to insinuating himself into the world of chart-tapping music, to still holding sway in federal prison, Supreme was feared, respected, and loved. It's interesting to think what he could have accomplished if he hadn't come up in the crack cocaine era in South Jamaica, Queens. Did he make the era, or did the era make him? We'll never know. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button and subscribe to the Al Profit YouTube channel.